This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. One of the potential presidential candidates for 2008 who hasn't gotten much attention lately is the Democrats' vice presidential nominee from 2004, John Edwards. Edwards decided not to run for re-election to the Senate that year, and he now runs an anti-poverty think tank at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But he stayed active politically, raising money and campaigning for other Democratic candidates. And he's made several trips to Iowa, ground zero for the next presidential race. Edwards' wife, Elizabeth, was diagnosed with breast cancer in the closing days of the 2004 campaign. But her husband reports she's now cancer-free. She's written a memoir called Saving Graces. And John Edwards has edited a collection of essays by a variety of Americans, some well-known, about their childhood homes. It's called Home: The Blueprints of Our Lives. I spoke to John Edwards yesterday. You know, as I thought about the theme of this book, Home and Your Life, one of the things that occurred to me is that no matter where you're from, no place could be farther from home in some ways than Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, we're from North Carolina. We're elected to the Senate, I guess, in 1998. Moved your family there. And I know that since you chose not to run for re-election, you and your family sold your house in Washington and moved back to North Carolina last year. And I'm wondering, what it does to live in Washington, a city that is so suffused with cynicism and ambition. You know, what that does that change you? Does it affect the way you and your family live?
It certainly has the potential to change people. There's no doubt about that, and there's no doubt it has changed some people. And I will be the first to admit, even I now live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, on 100 acres of land outside the town, amidst a bunch of farms, and I love it there. Man, do I love it there. And I like it a lot better than I liked living in Washington. But I think at the end of the day, home is the whatever city it's in, home is the environment in which you and your children and your family exist. And that's really, at least for us, you're right about everything you said about Washington, but within our own house and our own home, it's really very much the same as it was when we lived in North Carolina originally, then in Washington. And I might add, I've gotten this terrible habit from doing so much national campaigning, both for the ticket in 2004 and then in the most recent election, which we'll probably talk about. I did a lot of traveling. I campaigned for virtually every contested race in the country. And I had gotten this bad habit now at the end of the day when I'm going to my hotel room saying, boy, it's good to get home. It's like, this is not a healthy thing. Right. And my children were doing the same thing during the campaign. So I've unfortunately trained them to think the same way.
Home is someplace that has grass.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, John Edwards, I wanted to talk some about the experience of 2004. I mean, what a year in your life. And I note that late in the presidential campaign, your wife, Elizabeth, was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I certainly hope she's doing well. Your wife, Elizabeth, writes in her book, she has a couple of chapters on the experience of the campaign, and recalls at some point she realized that at her events they were only allowing the faithful into them, Democrats, and she insisted that everything be open to the public. I think had T-shirts printed saying open to the public because she thought it was so critical to engage people who thought differently.
And not only that, I had events where did the same thing that Elizabeth's talking about. And someone would, I'd always take a lot of questions in these town hall meetings, and someone would stand up with a position that was contrary to the standard Democratic position or is contrary to the position of most of the people in the hall. And it's such a, you know, it's a partisan campaign. So people would start booing or asking them, and you're in charge, you're the leader. And you have to say, I remember one example vividly of me having to say, no, let this young man talk. He deserves to be heard. I want to respond to what he's concerned about, what he's worried about. But that's an example of you have to really make an effort. Because if I just let that run its natural course, he would have basically been shouted down.
Did you insist on inviting the public to all your events?
I know that there came a point that we invited I think actually all of my events, my as a vice presidential candidate, all the big public events were open to everybody. We did some smaller events, like on porches and so forth, that were controlled. But the vast majority of the events were just open to anybody who wanted to come.
You know, the other thing about living in a Washington environment in a bubble is the way you see politicians become so relentlessly on message and cautious and unwilling to be candid. And I'm sure this is abetted by a 24-hour news cycle and cable TV stations and an opposition research organization that is ready to pounce on everything. Did you find yourself becoming more and more circumscribed?
I'll tell you, I think you have just put your finger on one of the single largest problems in American politics. What happens with politicians, and not like I haven't experienced it myself, I have, is that you're conditioned. You're conditioned not to be yourself. You're conditioned to say the same thing over and over and over, because that's the safe route. If you watch people go outside that, they get in trouble. But the truth of the matter is that what that does is it feeds the cynicism. It feeds the cynicism that people have about politicians. And it also feeds the toxicity that exists in American politics today, which is extraordinarily unhealthy. But unfortunately, it's married to the perception of a lot of politicians that pablum is what you should be giving the public. You know, that somehow they can't take the truth. You can't just tell them the truth and tell them when you disagree with them, tell them what you think is the right thing to do for the country. I think the result of all that is that we need to really change the way politics is conducted in America. We do. We need a leader or leaders who are willing to be themselves, who will tell the truth as they see it. Sometimes it'll be popular, sometimes it'll be less popular. And will stand up, as you point out, for what their convictions are, what is they actually believe. And I think anybody who were to do that would stand out like a neon light.
Well, I want to go over one moment in the campaign that generated some controversy, and that was during the vice presidential debate where you took on Dick Cheney, where the question came up about the Republicans' position on gay marriage, and you praised the vice president for his understanding of his lesbian daughter, Mary Cheney's lifestyle and you know, embracing her choice, embracing her decision. And of course, this generated enormous controversy because it was seen by some as you're finding a way to bring up something that social conservatives would not like to hear about the opposition ticket. I'm wondering, did you talk about bringing that up before the debate?
No. What happened was, no one remembers this, but what happened was, in the context of both the question and the campaign, a few weeks before our debate, Dick Cheney himself had brought up out on the campaign trail the issue of gay marriage and talked about his daughter and what their family had been through and how it's important to them to embrace her. And he talked about it at some length. And then I was aware of that. And then during the debate, no one, again, remembers this, but the first question wasn't to me on this issue. It was to the vice president. And the question was to Dick Cheney, you know, a question that put it, the question about gay marriage was in the context of his family, basically. And he answered the question. And when it came to me, I thought it was appropriate to point out that what he was doing in his personal life was something that most Americans, I believed, would applaud. Is it possible for you to imagine that being a negative thing? I didn't even think about it being a negative thing. It was one of the few non-acrimonious moments in a very bitter, tough debate, because he and I disagree about virtually everything. But that was a moment where that wasn't true. And then to contrast what he was saying with the position that that an ideological administration, the Bush administration, was taking. And that was my point, was that they were being hypocritical and he was doing the right thing within his own family. But he had brought this up himself, and it was in the question that went to him. So, and by the way, no one remembers this either. He thanked me for what I said. As I said, it was one of the few times that we
Well, maybe
at had actually had a very civil discussion.
Maybe at the time, but he and others and Mary Cheney criticized you harshly for it later.
Yes, that happened though after no one did at the time, and
so it's part of the political process later. You're saying
it was, and it really came after. If you remember, Senator Kerry in a later debate brought the issue up, and then I think it sort of rankled some people.
But you know, it strikes me as sort of the archetypical illustration of this dilemma in politics, because here we see John Edwards do this in a debate. And on the one hand, we say, look, isn't this great? The guy is reaching across this partisan divide and making a human connection. On the other hand, if we take it a deeper level, we could attribute a cynical motive because maybe he scores a political point by doing so. And since in the vortex of a campaign, the cynical interpretation will get a lot of ink, aren't you pressured then to kind of think cynically at the outset?
It is what this whole discussion that you and I just had is a wonderful example of the toxicity of American politics. I mean, the fact that I can't say what I'm actually thinking at the time, and the way everything will get taken and twisted and turned and done over and over and over on right-wing radio and Rush Limbaugh and all that stuff. We ought to have vigorous and open debate, but what happens is that people take anything you say, they turn it, they twist it, they take, as you put it, they put the most cynical interpretation on it, and the result is you get plastic politicians who won't ever say anything. You get people who won't stand up for their belief system, and the public looks at politicians on TV, and everybody sounds alike. And all they get is pablum. They don't get anything real and meaningful out of them. So I really believe that our country's better than this, and the politicians are underestimating our people, and I think that theory ought to be tested.
Well, we'll see if you give it a test. You know, I wanted to just ask one more question about 2004. You know, when you're the vice presidential candidate, you are a part of the team, you're in on key strategy discussions, but it's different from your previous campaigns where you're in charge. You have a voice but not the say. And I'm wondering, I'm sure you've thought about the campaign. It was close. What could the campaign have done differently that might have allowed them to win?
Oh, I try not to go back and analyze it. Of course I do. I'm human like anybody else. I'm not for a minute want to mislead anybody into thinking I haven't thought about what could have been done differently and better. But there, the things that could have been done differently and better are the obvious things that everyone's talked about, including my running mate. So, you know, there's the Swift boat issue. There's the issue about the war in Iraq. Being clear about huge issues like that. But that's all 2020 hindsight. You know, we were in the middle, as you put it, we were in the middle of the vortex, and you learn. I mean, you learn. One of the great things that this experience has taught me is that America is looking for leaders, not politicians. America is looking for somebody, a man or woman of strength who will stand for what they believe in, who has a real vision for where America is going to go, and we talked about this a few minutes ago, and somebody who will be themselves, who's comfortable in their own skin, for good and bad. And I think that's one of the great lessons of this whole process.
You know, you decided not to run for re-election in 2004, and lo and behold, 2 years later, Democrats now will control both houses of Congress. And I'm wondering if you wish you were there, but I guess my more direct question is, what should Democrats do? They've been criticized for standing against things but failing to present a coherent vision. Let's talk about Iraq. What should they do in Iraq?
We have to change course in Iraq. And the Democrats, we don't have the White House, but the Democrats should lead the way to the extent they're capable of, since we're now in control of the Congress. And I think the American people spoke very loudly in this election in 2006 about Iraq. They made it clear they want to see a change in policy, a change in course. At least from my perspective, what we should be doing in Iraq is making it clear that we're going to leave, that the best way to prove that is to actually start leaving. You know, if I were in charge, I'd take at least 40,000 troops out immediately from the secure regions of Iraq. I'd be saying to my military leadership, I want to see a plan to have our combat troops out of Iraq in, you know, roughly 12 to 18 months. No exact time, but I'd want to see the most efficient, most effective way to accomplish that.
Well, you know, if I can just interrupt, Senator, sure, I mean, that's a decisive step. But if you look at the reports from Iraq, it's hard to find any evidence that Iraq's security forces are going to be able to cope. And I'm wondering if doing that, withdrawing 40,000 troops and then indicating that more are to follow, if you see escalating violence and disintegration, is that an outcome that Democrats can accept?
First of all, I think that anybody who says to the American people that we can have followed this course and we will be successful and Iraq will be democratic and secure is not telling the truth. We are in a terrible place in Iraq. We should be honest about that. We should be honest about how we got there. How in the world can we have the moral authority to lead in the world without a foundation of honesty? You know, we thought that he had weapons of mass destruction. He did not. People like me voted for this war. I was wrong. And we need to tell the country the truth about that. And then we need to say to the country, we have bad choices and worse choices, because this is the situation we're confronted with. And by the way, the men and women who are serving in Iraq, they didn't make a mistake. They're there serving heroically on behalf of us, our country. So we owe it to them to do what's right and the best thing under the circumstances and not be driven by ideology. And to me, the best way to improve the chances of being successful, because if you look what's happening now, the situation is extraordinarily unstable. The situation, particularly around Baghdad, is chaotic. We're clearly policing a low-level civil war. There's no question about that. And at some point, the Iraqis, we've been there for years now, spent many billions of dollars. At some point, they're going to actually have to look out for themselves. And we can't be the policemen of this ethnic violence that's going on every single day in Iraq. Now, I would add, because I didn't say this earlier, I think it's important also for us to reach out to other countries, other leaders in that region of the world, to say, you've been saying you want to secure Iraq, and you can't do it because America is an occupying force there. Well, now's your chance to prove it. They clearly aren't going to do it as long as we're there in the numbers and the force that we have on the ground in Iraq right now.
You've visited Iowa several times since last year. Are you running for president?
Maybe.
What does
maybe
it,
that's a resounding maybe.
Well, I didn't expect anything different. What does it depend on?
First and foremost, that Elizabeth continued to do well, and you were nice enough to ask about her earlier. She's doing great, and then just a judgment at the time about whether I think it's good for my country for me to do this. Once I've gotten by the question of whether it's good for my family, is it good for my country? Do I have a vision for America and the world that I think needs to be heard?
You know, I have to ask you your reaction to John Kerry's comment that created such a firestorm of controversy before the election when he, in a speech, ended up saying that if you don't get an education, you could get stuck in Iraq, and conservatives tried to suggest that he was demeaning troops. He said he was simply botched a joke about President Bush. You had so much experience with John Kerry during that intense 2004 campaign. I was wondering what went through your mind as you watched that unfold.
Oh, I felt bad for him. I just felt bad for him. He's my friend. It wasn't complicated. I felt bad for him, and I told some of my friends, I said, I could have already told you that neither John Kerry or John Edwards could tell a joke. So I wasn't surprised that he botched the joke. But I just felt badly for him. I think he just made a mistake, and it spiraled out of control. And I think the Republicans were looking for anything they could grab hold of in a case situation where they were about to lose, as they did.
You're now president of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. It's, I guess one might describe it as a think tank looking at ways that Americans can fight poverty. You know, during the 2004 campaign, you were famous for a Two Americas speech in which you talked about, the well-off America and the forgotten America, to paraphrase. And you've been spending a lot of time on this issue, I noticed you did a tour with some hotel union workers advocating for better wages and working conditions there. I mean, do you see the fight against poverty as the issue of 2008?
The truth of the matter is when I go to my grave, if I feel like I've done something serious about poverty in America, I'll feel like I did something good with my life. And that's the way I think about this. I don't have any way of knowing what the political implications are, negative or positive. I mean, there weren't many people doing anything about it. I thought there was a vacuum. I cared about it, and so that's what I've been trying to do.
Well, John Edwards, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Former Senator John Edwards is now director of the Center for Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's edited a new book called Home, The Blueprints of Our Lives.